Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens, families, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I'd like to welcome Ruby Walker to 411 Teen. Advice I Ignored, Stories and Wisdom from a Formerly Depressed Teen, is the only book on teenage mental health and depression written by a teenager. It's an important resource for teens suffering from depression, parents who have one, and educators who want to help. Ruby Walker is an 18-year-old college student, artist, and writer. Ruby grew up in Austin, Texas, moved down to Buda, Texas, dropped out of high school, earned her full-time tuition to a private university, and is currently studying art at Trinity University in San Antonio. Ruby, welcome to 411 Teen.
Hi, it's such a pleasure to be on this radio show with you.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to it. I loved your book, and you have so much that you could share with us, so I'm really looking forward to talking with you. Ruby, first of all, how long had you been struggling with depression?
I think it came on pretty fast for me. I think that I had a lot of things that were going on with my emotions that were sort of like laying the groundwork mm-hmm. for it to get really bad for a couple of years, you know, going into my adolescence when I was, you know, 13, 14. Mm-hmm. But it hit me really bad when I was a sophomore in high school, the fall semester, I think just about halfway through. It got really bad. I'm trying to find good language for it, but and then over that winter, the winter break, it was bad. And
how did it affect you? I mean, how did it make you feel? How did it impact your life? Did it alter your behavior at all? Tell us what depression meant to you.
It was like everything that I enjoyed doing and the things that I sort of built my little identity around just sort of stopped making me happy. You know, I had lots of interests. I was a really, 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 I mean, my mom would say that the word to describe me when I was a child was fierce. I would want to fight, not fight, but if, mm-hmm. if for example, at one point when I was in sixth grade, I had like a science teacher who said that mass was the same as weight. And I thought that, I knew that that was wrong. So I was like, hey, and I wouldn't condone this kind of behavior now because, you know, it was a little bit annoying, but this is my personality. I was like, hey, that's not true. And she was like, hey, quiet down. So I went home and I wrote a whole paper about the difference between mass and weight. And then I turned it in because I just wanted to, if something I didn't think was right was going on, I wanted to go right at it, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any kind of fear about that. Mm-hmm. And then instead of feeling like that, instead of feeling, you know, excited about going after things I didn't think was right, I just kind of, I got really, really quiet. The things that I wanted to say, I just kind of felt like they were stuck in my head. It's hard to describe the depression succinctly. I'm kind of struggling because it was not really just a feeling, but a complete world that I was living in. You know, mm-hmm. Like a total mindset and worldview that encompassed everything. So I would, it just.
Did it impact your schoolwork, your academics?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was a big part of it, actually, is that it was really hard to do anything. Mm-hmm. I felt like I would think about something that I needed to do. Like, I would, this is something that I put in the book. I would be sitting in bed thinking about turning off a dripping faucet. And I would sit there and kind of stare at the ceiling and think about that. And when I wanted my body to get up and do it, nothing would happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, I would just kind of be in this headspace where I just felt paralyzed, like I couldn't do anything that I wanted to do. And then it was more frustrating because that impacted my schoolwork. It was hard for me to make myself get up and go to school. It was hard for me to make myself pay attention in class. It was hard for me to make myself do homework because I think a lot of things that people thought should have been easy for me were actually a very large amount of effort. You know, mm-hmm. It was like running a marathon.
Mm-hmm. What about your friends and those that were around you? Did anyone notice it or pick it up or make comments to you about this change? Because it sounds like it was a total turnaround for you, totally, mm-hmm. from what you had been to what you were experiencing then. Was you were just a different person.
Mm-hmm. I did have friends who noticed. I'll never forget my best friend, who's actually still my best friend, back then in high school, Alicia. She wrote me this letter in November of that year when I was kind of in the middle of falling into a really bad place. Mm-hmm. She wrote me a letter and put it in my backpack that was just basically like, hey, I've noticed that you're going through a really rough time right now. Just to let you know, I think you're a wonderful person and I'm going to stick by you. And I mean, at the time, that mattered to me, but I think it mattered more and more going into the future. Like, especially when I was coming out of the depression, it mm-hmm. just reminded me that she was really like a true friend to me. When it was really bad.
What about your parents? Did they notice it?
I think, yeah, my mom noticed. I think she always said the right thing to me, which is that, I mean, the first, when she was first noticing, it was that I just kept getting into dumb fights with her. So I think at first she was actually just kind of annoyed because she, you know, wanted to get along with me, and I would pick fights with her about, you know, stupid things like taking the trash out or doing the dishes and stuff. Because part of it was I was pretty irritable. Mm-hmm. Or if anybody mentioned to me that they didn't think I was doing well, I would get very defensive. Mm-hmm. But later on, when we both, I told her sometime in that winter, I ended up telling her, I think I'm depressed, and she was a big support after that.
What type of interventions did you use? Did you seek a therapist, go to a psychiatrist, have an evaluation? How did you approach that?
I never saw a therapist, and this isn't something that I recommend to anyone or would, you know, encourage any of my friends to do, because I think that everything was a lot harder for me because I never got professional help. All the things that I ended up learning to recover, I had to sort of go through the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't pleasant. But my mom told me that I could see a therapist if I wanted to. And she said that she would help me do that. But I was kind of in a place where I had very, very, very little self-worth. Mm. And I was concerned that it would be a burden to my family to go out of their way to get me therapy or take me to the doctor or something, you know, because it costs money and it takes time. And I just didn't, I didn't feel like it was important enough that I get help.
Okay. So your self-worth was zero.
Yeah, basically.
That's what it's
And that was a big part of it. Mm-hmm. This is helping, like, these questions are helping me come together for a good answer to what the depression was like. That was a big pillar of it, was that I just had, I hated myself so mm-hmm. much all the time. Anything mm-hmm. that happened, if something went badly, in my head, it would be like, this is your fault. This mm-hmm. is terrible. This is going to be bad forever. And it's all because of you and because you're bad and all this kind of stuff. Like, so much of the mental stress was just me, like, piling blame onto myself for everything that happened.
Mm-hmm. What was the significance and the title of your book, Advice I Ignored, Stories and Wisdom from a Formerly Depressed Teen?
Yeah, so the title actually came to me the very first day that I sat down to write the book. It was one of the first things that happened. I just basically went out on my lawn and sat in a lawn chair with a little notebook and started writing an introduction when I was 16. And the title came really fast because I got a lot of advice when I was depressed from a lot of different people. But most of it I sort of brushed off or didn't want to hear, or I felt like if people were giving me advice, then they were sort of attacking me. Like, if there's something that I can do about this, then you're saying that it's my fault. Or like if somebody says, hey, maybe you should, get some exercise and that'll help you. I would think like, hey, like, who are you to tell me what to do? Mm-hmm. Or that kind of stuff. So I thought a big thing when I was writing the book was to try to get past that defensiveness a little bit somehow, because I knew that when I was struggling, there was a lot of help that I needed.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield, and I'm talking with Ruby Walker. We're talking about teen depression. We'll take a break, and we'll get right back at you. What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield, and I'm talking with Ruby Walker. Ruby is an artist and an author and a student, and she wrote Advice I Ignored, Stories and Wisdom from a Formerly Depressed Teen. Ruby, I had to interrupt you. But we can
no problem.
Go back. Yeah, we can get back to, you were talking about just how you kind of handled it and how you were writing the book and the inspirations you had. So if you don't mind, mm-hmm. you can continue.
Oh, okay, thank you. I thought that the most important thing when I was writing the book is that it be accessible. Mm-hmm. And that it be, if I was giving any kind of advice, that it come not from, me standing up on a cliff, looking down on someone, telling them, hey, just get back up here, but really like coming down and sitting at the bottom of the ravine with that someone and like really just being there with them, you know? So I wanted, if I had any advice in the book, I wanted it to come from a place of like, hey, I got this advice. I thought it was stupid too. I didn't want to take it. I rolled my eyes. But it really did end up helping me a little bit. So maybe possibly consider it. You don't have to. You know, I wanted it to come mm-hmm. from a place of respecting people's, respecting people's skepticism.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you get, I have to ask, how did you get from in the pits to writing a book? I mean, I missed that whole part.
Yeah, I mean, it was a process. I think it kind of all started when I dropped out of high school because...
What was the impetus for that? Why did you drop out of high school? What was going on?
It became so hard for me to go that I really didn't know how I was going to continue. I remember that time I would wake up in the morning and just be thinking to myself, like, how can I convince my mother to let me stay home today? You know, how can I like get out of this, somehow? Because, I don't know. I think it was that, you know, it was really difficult for me, to make myself do things, you know, it was difficult for me to just function, on a lot of levels, especially doing homework and keeping up with a schedule. And I had the pressure of grades. I had always been, not to brag or flex or anything, mm-hmm. but I had always been a really good student. And at this time, at the beginning of the spring semester, my sophomore year, I was failing my math class. I had never failed a class before, and I couldn't even like find the emotional range to be that panicked about it. So yeah, school wasn't going well for me, and I didn't know how I was going to keep going with it. So I was faking sick a lot. Mm-hmm. And my mother told me that if I wanted to, I could just try being homeschooled for the rest of the semester. So that's what I did. I went one last day, I think it was February 4th, and I remember because it was right before my 15th birthday, which is February 7th. It was that week. I went one last day, and I showed up to school basically just to say hi to some of my friends. I skipped a couple of my classes and just went to lunch multiple times to see everyone. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I... basically stopped going. I don't think I even told most people that it was going to be my last day. I just kind of stopped. And that was in the end really important to my recovery, I think, because I had this expectation that it was being in school that was going to be the problem, and that it would be really easy for me to recover if I didn't have that pressure on mm-hmm. me all the time. But so for the first couple of days or the first couple of weeks after I dropped out, I was really ecstatic because I was just kind of like, oh, I don't have to do anything.
Okay.
So I would just go sit outside and like lay face down on the lawn and just sit there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really freeing at first, until I sort of realized that the pressure of getting things done all the time, even though I couldn't do things, was off. But I still couldn't do things, and I was still very much depressed in that time. I think that sort of was the impetus for a realization that mm-hmm. if I was going to get better, I was going to have to make some kind of change with myself and not just my environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, self-hatred appeared to permeate your very existence.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about 7 steps to stop the hate. Would you share those with us at this point? Or some of those, whatever you feel comfortable doing?
Yeah, of course. I actually don't know if I remember like which number is or
right.
if it's the 7 thing, but I can talk about sort of how I ended up coming out of hating myself that
mm-hmm.
much. I think that there is a sort of weird, ironic level of arrogance that comes into hating yourself a lot because I always had this idea in my head that, you know, I have my friends, I have the people in the world that I love and respect, and you know, I thank my mom for raising me right, I guess, but I always thought that, you know, everybody in the world deserves a baseline of respect. They deserve to get the benefit of the doubt. They deserve to, you know, be treated with kindness. And the arrogance comes in is that I thought that about everybody else in the world except me. Somehow I'm different, you know. Somehow I'm the only person in the world who's actually the worst. and doesn't deserve the benefit of the doubt and doesn't deserve kindness and all that kind of stuff. So I guess with the self-hatred, I had to come to a point where I was like, okay, whether or not I actually am a good person, whether or not I deserve this, the self-hatred has made me so miserable that I am going to at least try to pretend that I don't hate myself. And that's kind of where it started, is I started on the level of, like, maybe I can't jump straight to loving myself. Maybe I can't jump straight to everything being hunky-dory. Mm-hmm. But if I don't at least try to make believe that I am a person who deserves respect, then I don't know what I'm going to do. So that started with, I decided to stop making self-deprecating jokes about myself, because I used to do that all the time, and it was something that was really popular with my friends, too. You know, something would happen, and I'd just be like, oh, I hate myself. You know, automatic reaction. So I didn't know how to change my thoughts, so I decided to, you know, just start with the words that I said out loud, and just stop saying negative things about myself.
And you just came up, you just decided this on your own.
Yeah. It was around the summer after I dropped out. I really just thought that, I'm sure that it was some kind of advice that had been given to me by someone else at some point that I had just sort of tossed away. And then I got to that point of desperation where I was like, even if I think it's cheesy, I'm going to take some kind of advice, you know, and just see if it works, because I don't have anything left to lose.
And that ties,
I couldn't get more miserable.
And again, that ties in with the title of your book.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That ties directly.
It's this idea of, like, maybe just maybe, even if I think it's cheesy or dumb, I'll just try something else, because what I've been doing just hasn't been working. You know, hating myself didn't make me a better person. It didn't make me more productive. It made me, you know, paralyzed and miserable, you know?
When you were writing this book, who is it written for? Is it for teens? Is it for parents? Is it for teachers? Who is it for? All the above, A, B, C, or D?
I think that all of the above I think anybody who reads it, this is a little bit self-aggrandizing, but I think anybody who reads it can get something out of it, you know, even if you're just a person in the world who's trying to understand more about other people, you can get something out of it. But the target audience, first and foremost, was always teenagers. Or not just teenagers, really, but I didn't presume to know about the adult depressed experience because I hadn't been an adult yet. So I narrowed it down to my own age group, but it's really for people who are going through depression. That's who I wrote it kind of in my head, imagining that I was writing a letter to my 14-year-old self. You know, like the kind of, I wanted to make the thing that I wanted to read.
Well, what I thought it was very well done. I really liked how at the end you had advice on whatever it is, like advice. You've always felt that everything was your fault. So you had advice on how to change faulty thinking. At whatever chapter it was, there was some advice, and I thought that was really very effective, and that individuals, whoever is reading it, could connect to that. So that was well done, and I applaud you on your book.
Thank you.
Yeah. How did you change that faulty thinking?
It started with pretending.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say it started with make believe. I just instead of making self-deprecating jokes, I started making self-aggrandizing jokes. You know, if I messed up a drawing that I was doing, and my automatic reaction would be to say, "Oh, I suck at this." I would just make it a sarcastic joke instead and say, "Oh, I'm the best painter alive," or something like that. You know, just to sort of flip it on its head. And even though I didn't really believe those things, it did have an effect on my mood. So I decided to keep with that and keep with the sort of faking it till you make it mindset. I would like look in the mirror and do that thing where you put your hands on your hips and you're like, I am a good person who deserves respect. And I felt really goofy when I was doing it, but it helped a little bit. And then I guess besides those two things, which is just to say nice things about yourself, another thing I did, I think I read this in some other book about fixing your self-esteem. I did a lot of Googling.
Mm, I see.
I was kind of a Google sleuth.
Mm-hmm.
I would close my eyes and stand in front of the mirror, and I would imagine my friend Brew, who is really cool and who I love a lot, and I would think about like some of the things that I would beat myself up for or that I would hate about myself were also present in my friends. You know, like Brew is a fantastic, beautiful, handsome man, but he also has acne on his face, and I had acne, and I hated myself for it, but I never hated Brew for it. So I would imagine him, and I would think about how much I respect him and how cool I think he is, and then I would open my eyes, and I would try to, like, quick flash, like, transfer that feeling over to myself. I'd be like, hey, how come I don't hate Brew for this, but I hate myself? You know, I would try to, like, trick my brain.
Obviously, it was working. Did you find that writing this book was, a creative outlet?
Yeah, I think writing the book over the year and a half that I was doing all the text for it really a really big change happened in my personality when I was recovering from depression. I really felt like I had somehow like become a totally different person, a little bit, you know, slowly, and then looking back, very much so. But at the same time, I didn't really understand everything that had happened. And I still don't know if I completely understand, but writing the book and trying to pull it apart for somebody else to understand, for somebody else to know, hey, what are the things that happened? I wrote the book not chronologically, but based on like topics. I think that helped me. I use the word understand too much, but
no, that conveys what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. It helped me get a grasp on, my own history to think like, hey, what did happen? And then it's also been nice because, you know, problems don't go away forever.
Right.
They get better, but, I still have a lot of the same, like, self-critical tendencies, but I keep them in check. And it's nice to have something that I wrote that kind of represents like my best intentions, that I can look back on and be like, hey, I need to take my own advice.
Right. For those who are listening, we're talking about this book, but we need to let them know where they can purchase the book. Ruby Walker is the author of Advice I Ignored, Stories and Wisdom from a Formerly Depressed Teen. It's the only book on teenage depression written by a teenager. And that's what we're talking about this hour on 411 Teen. Ruby, where can folks get your book? Where can they purchase it? Is it online? Amazon? Share with
online.
Us.
Online. It's available on Amazon right now as a paperback and as a Kindle ebook. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon I'm going to record an audiobook, but that's not ready yet. yeah. And then if you go to, so you can buy the book on Amazon.com. You can go and search up Advice I Ignored, Ruby Walker, and it should come up. And if you happen to go to my college, you can also buy a copy from me in my dorm room. But that's it for now.
Well, that's good. That's good. Where are you now?
I am, in life or physically?
Well, both. I mean, you know, you left home and you went mm-hmm. to the university. Mm-hmm. And then, I guess, what are you doing? And where are you? And what is it all about at this point? Mm-hmm. I mean, I just kind of like to get a feel for what's happening with you
mm-hmm.
emotionally, physically. We're going to take a break. As I'm looking at the time, I think we can take a break and you can come back and we'll talk about where you are, what's happening, and kind of go from there. There's a lot more advice that I'm sure you can share. We're going to take a break, but we'll return shortly.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I am talking about Ruby Walker. At 15 years of age, she went from a numb, silent, miserable high school dropout to a joyous, she describes loudmouth in 1 year. So I'm using your words, okay?
Yes.
Ruby, just what happened? Where are you? And tell us, what's your secret?
So where am I now? those are a lot of questions. I don't think it's one secret. I think the secret to recovering from depression is that there is not one single secret. There's not a magic button. There's not probably going to be a single turning point that you reach where everything all of a sudden gets better and starts to be okay. Mm-hmm. Recovery is not a pivot. It's a slow curve. And it's based on little decisions that you make every single day, just choosing to be a little tiny bit better or even just to hold on and let nothing happen that day. It's something that I always have to remind myself that it's all about deciding that you care enough about yourself to want to get better and to want to find a way to be okay, and then being patient with it. But where I am right now, physically, I'm in my front yard at home for winter break. Emotionally and life-wise, I just finished my first semester at Trinity, my first semester of real university. I had been going to community college as a dual credit student before that. And that was really nice because I felt like I could get back into learning things because I like learning again instead of rushing to 8 classes every day. That was really
nice. That's great.
I kind of, in general, I went into my first semester of real university with a lot of hubris. I thought mm-hmm. that it was going to be easy,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't realize that no matter who you are or how much of a handle you think you have on things, going to live in a completely new place is going to be an adjustment. So I think that I went a little bit feral there for part of the semester. I have these routines that I have in my life that keep me happy and stable, or even if not happy, they keep me stable. You know, I like to sleep at night and be awake during the day
mm-hmm.
and make sure that I eat 3 meals and that I get a little bit of exercise. And those are sort of things that, because I have been depressed and because I have had problems with being mentally ill, I have to be very vigilant about having, like, stable routines in my lifestyle. Otherwise, I kind of it never gets as bad as it was,
right.
But I have little, like, it's something that I always have to pay attention to.
Let's look at those. Were those, when you talk about sleep and exercise and eating, were mm-hmm. they a void when you were really depressed? Did you find that you had problems sleeping, that you got little exercise, your appetite was gone? How did they manifest during your depression?
I was never a sporty kid, so I never really got regular exercise at any point in my life. That was something I had to learn how to do,
okay.
specifically because I wanted to stabilize my mood. But yeah, eating is kind of the first thing to go with me, I've noticed. If I start having like a rough couple of weeks, the first thing that is sort of a red flag for me is that I'll be sitting around doing something or sitting in bed and I'll notice that I'm hungry, or I'll notice that it's time to eat a meal, you know, it's like noon and mm-hmm. I should eat lunch, and I just won't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that comes from a place of just like doing things for your body that show that you care, and
okay.
doing things that show that you want to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And sleeping and eating and exercise are all those things for me. So I think even more than on a physical level, on a mental level, when I am doing those things, it's my way of showing myself that I do really care.
As you talk about these signs or indicators that something may be going awry, what should parents or educators look for in their students or their child that may be an indicator that something's not quite right?
Some of the signs with me were really obvious because I would just cry during class. That was another way that depression was for me. It isn't like this for everyone. Some people
right.
don't cry as easily as I did, but I would cry like multiple times per day. I would cry in one class and then pack my things up and go to another class and also cry there. So that's one thing. Another thing I would do is that I just couldn't pay attention. For parents and educators, I think it's really just that I don't think any kid wants to not do good, you
mm-hmm.
know? I don't think any kid wants to you know, feel like a failure. So if there's something that someone is in your class, for example, I would go to math class every day, and I would probably, I think I wanted to learn how to do math. I wanted to learn how to do algebra, but instead I would sit in class and I would just, like, draw circles all over my notebook over and over and over and over again, because when someone isn't able to do the work in your class, it's probably because there's some part of it, there's
mm-hmm.
something else that's making them struggle, you know, there's there's some part of the work that they don't feel like they can do by themselves. I don't think anybody is lazy inherently, you know?
Do you have any suggestions that you would offer to parents or to teachers, you know, educators, of how they may approach the student or their child that they have concern about? Once they've identified, because it sounds like you're saying, and tell me if I'm incorrect, what one can do is look for any change in behavior. You had done well in school. You no longer were doing well in school. You were enthusiastic, always involved, challenging. You no longer did any of that. So you were having problems sleeping. You know, your energy was zero, basically. So what I'm hearing is that there are some real changes that your friends noticed. Once this has been identified and parents are noticing this, or educators, how would you suggest, given just your experience, the best way to approach that person, whether it's a student or their child?
I think number one is just to try to be empathetic and understanding that things that might be really easy for most people become really, really difficult for someone when they're depressed. So I think there can be a lot of frustration when dealing with somebody who is depressed if you don't understand what is going on inside of them, because oftentimes I tried to cover it up or I wouldn't talk about it. But I think it's approaching someone, it's really good to just not come at it from an angle of, hey, here's all these things that you're supposed to be doing. Why aren't you doing them? And to be disappointed or upset with their lack of seeming productivity, because it might be that they're trying really, really, really hard, and they might be the person who is most frustrated at the lack of results, you know? I guess when approaching someone, you might want to come up and just say, like, hey, I noticed that you're going through a really rough time. I understand that things are probably very, very hard right now, but I want you to know that I am going to stick by you and that I believe that things are going to be okay for you, even if you don't believe that right now.
And letting them know that you're there and that you care.
Just letting them know that you're there, that you care, and that even if things are really ugly for them right now, that you aren't going to be disappointed and that you aren't going to judge.
Okay. All right. I know planning was major for you and your dealing, coping with depression. Planning was major in accomplishing your goals. How does one approach the big goal that they may have set for themselves? How do you suggest they move in that direction?
This is really fun. I ended up learning about planning and goal setting and all that kind of stuff because when I was going to start at community college, they made me take this mandatory class on, like, it seemed really dorky to me at the time, like study skills and time management and stuff. And I was like, yeah, whatever, big eye roll. But it ended up not just being super useful for my studies, which it was, but also really useful for just learning how to set goals and expectations for myself generally in life, because I think part of helping raise my really bad self-esteem and feeling like I could do things, because I felt so paralyzed, so stagnant, and like I couldn't get up and take a shower, you know, mm-hmm. things like that, mm-hmm. I would really struggle with. I mean, looking back, it's a little bit gross, but I was really dirty, because I just would not, I had some kind of mental block about showering. I wanted to take the goal setting stuff and apply it to even just the really small things in my life, or things that might seem small to other people that were big to me. I'm going to take the example of showering and use that with specificity so that...
Okay.
Because specificity is also a big part of goal setting.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I would be sitting around and I would think, oh gosh, I'm greasy, I should take a shower. And it was this should in my head that didn't created like a feeling of guilt, but I didn't really do anything about it. So it was just, like, I would feel bad about it, but nothing would get done because I was just thinking like, oh, I should do this. Or like, oh, I should clean this whole room. But what I learned about goal setting is that you want to make your goals, even if it's something simple, you want it to be specific. So I think like, okay, not I'm going to clean my whole room, but I'm going to make my bed. You want okay. it to be something that you are able to measure your progress in. And then you want it to be something that you have a specific time also set for. I would think like, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to break this into the smallest possible steps. I'm going to sit up and get out of bed and stand on the floor.
Okay.
And then I'm going to go into my bathroom and take all my clothes off and get into the shower and turn the water on. So I would break it into the smallest possible parts for the things that I wanted to make myself do. And then once you feel like, okay, I set out to take a shower and I did it, that's like, ding, that's one more little point
to that
your,
you,
like, belief mm-hmm. that you can do the things that you want to do, you know?
I understand completely. I just small successive steps till you get to that mm-hmm. big goal.
Yeah.
And our I can't believe it, you know, time is running. Are there any resources or apps that you would recommend in addition to your book? I mean, again, let's talk about this book real quickly. Ruby Walker, mm-hmm. Advice I Ignored, Stories and Wisdom from a Formerly Depressed Teen. Where can they get it? Again, where can my listening audience purchase this book? Where is it available?
It is available on Amazon.com currently.
okay.
And you can search up Advice I Ignored.
Okay.
It should pop right up.
Okay. That takes care of that. When you think about where you've been, what has mm-hmm. been the most challenging component of your journey to this part?
I think the most challenging component of my journey has been, yeah, truthfully, I think the most challenging part hasn't really been the depression itself, but mm-hmm. this idea that always pops up that like, aha, now that I've recovered, I'm never going to deal with this again.
Mm-hmm.
It's never going to be a problem ever again. I'm totally solid forever. And when I start getting into that mindset, then I start slipping on the things that I need to do to feel stable. So I stop exercising as regularly because uh-huh. I think like, hey, I've got this handled. I don't need to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing I know, I'm in a major slump because I've forgotten that it's not an achievement to be happy. It's a process and a mm-hmm. practice that you always have to put work into.
Okay. Well, we are out of time. I just want to say thank you. I appreciate you sharing your experience, and to my listening audience, appreciation for your time and ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place. Get 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.